This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You know, the real crunch in terms of the fiscal problems that we've seen Ethiopia have over the last couple of years and the worsening of its fiscal situation has meant that Ethiopia is now paying. You know, it is agreeing to come into line with these international standards. And this is largely being designed to meet the IMF requirements.
That's Ahmed Soliman, Senior Research Fellow, Africa Program at Chatham House, on Ethiopia's economic reform package. Details coming up. Also, U.S. officials say the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, has bolstered economic progress in sub-Saharan Africa. And Sudan says General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan survived a drone attack that killed 5 people. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ethiopia said Monday it is easing foreign exchange curbs as part of an economic reform package as the deeply indebted nation awaits a multi-billion dollar bailout from international lenders such as the International Monetary Fund. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the reform agenda will lay the foundation for economic growth and job creation. Ahmed Soliman, Senior Research Fellow for the African Program at Chatham House in London, says the reform package is a big shift as it is part of the liberalization of the Ethiopian economy. But he cautions that the economic trajectory can be derailed because of the ongoing conflict and unrest in Ethiopia.
I think layman's terms is a good way to start. Essentially, this is quite historic shift for Ethiopia, you know, because we're talking about the actual, it's seemingly liberalization of Ethiopia's economy. So both the kind of foreign exchange system, shifting towards a market-based regime, you know, trying to ease the kind of crippling foreign currency shortages that have been in the country since Abiy's government took over, and even before that, and trying to boost private sector led growth. It is a huge shift when you think about the state led development policies of the former government under the EPRDF, and actually, you know, the promise to liberalise early on under the Prosperity Party before that, when Abiy took over, but a realization of the difficulties in doing so, kind of curbing some of those liberalizations. So you kind of had one foot in and one foot out. But I think the real crunch in terms of the fiscal problems that we've seen Ethiopia have over the last couple of years and the worsening of its fiscal situation has meant that Ethiopia is now paying. You know, it is agreeing to come into line with these international standards. This is largely being designed to meet the IMF requirements to unlock a lot of funding from both the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, the World Bank and other creditors. So it's really to try and assuage those creditors, a number of them to whom Ethiopia holds quite substantial amounts of debt.
Mr. Soliman, you're right. The IMF has been calling for numerous reforms of Ethiopia's tight state-controlled economy, including floating the currency in order to unlock the funding. But the Horn of Africa nation is battered in recent years by several armed conflicts, the COVID pandemic, climate shocks, and it has about, what, $28 billion of external debt. And it's also grappling with sky-high inflation and a shortage of foreign currency reserves. So with all this, can they really implement what they're actually trying to do?
This is the difficult question. As we've seen immediately, in terms of the immediate impact, there's been a 30% devaluation of the birr against the dollar, which, of course, will immediately contribute to inflationary rises in some commodities. So there is a worry, I think, and there has been a worry in terms of the negotiations, which have rumbled on for some time, over this issue of devaluation in particular, and whether or not the inflation that we see will have not only a further, because we've seen, you know, inflation going to double digit figures, impact on the spending power and livelihoods of Ethiopians every day, and whether or not that leads to further unrest in the country, which, let's be very clear, Ethiopia cannot afford, given, as you pointed out, I mean, one of the most crippling parts of the economic trajectory since 2019 and certainly late 2020 has been the evolution of unrest, war in Ethiopia in the north, the kind of conflict we have seen in both Oromia, the Amhara region, Benishangul, other parts of the country which persists, and that uncertain picture, which of course is a deterrent to economic growth, to stability, to any sort of foreign direct investment, certainly. So I think this is a big gamble, therefore, in that regard. But it's a longer term one, and it would be one that would have to be based and predicated on increased stability within the country.
That's Ahmed Soliman, senior research fellow, Africa Program at Chatham House. He talked to me from London. Senior U.S. officials say the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, has made a difference in driving economic progress in sub-Saharan Africa, improving the lives of people across the region. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Speaking during an online news briefing late Monday, senior U.S. officials reiterated the U.S. government's commitment to AGOA, including promoting trade policies to drive economic opportunity for countries of sub-Saharan Africa. Constance Hamilton is the Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for Africa.
Over the past 24 years, AGOA has made a tangible difference in the lives of millions of Africans, new jobs, new business opportunities, but we recognize that we can do much better. The United States looks forward to working together with our partners on the continent in charting the path of not only transforming and modernizing our partnership, but also ensuring that AGOA realizes its full potential of promoting inclusive and sustainable economic growth, development, and regional integration.
The United States hosted the 21st AGOA Forum in Washington last week. It was attended by government officials from both the United States and Africa, as well as representatives from continental and regional economic organizations, the private sector, and civil society. Hamilton offered details.
We explored barriers that women, youth, micro and small and medium-sized enterprises, and the African diaspora face in assessing trade and investment opportunities. We explored how to better use the multilateral trading system to benefit more people, especially those in underserved communities.
As the stakeholders gathered in the U.S. Capitol for the three-day forum, President Joe Biden called on Congress to quickly reauthorize and modernize the Landmark Act, which is set to expire in 2025. Joy Basu is the U.S. Department of State's Deputy Assistant Secretary for African Affairs.
Biden Harris administration has reiterated our strong support for the U.S. Congress to reauthorize the AGOA legislation and to do so as soon as possible. That was a main focus of the AGOA forum. AGOA is an important cornerstone of our trade and investment relationship with sub-Saharan Africa, but there are many other programs that work in a symbiotic way with AGOA.
Enacted in May 2000, the AGOA is the cornerstone of U.S. economic and commercial engagement with the countries of sub-Saharan Africa. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Hamas says its top political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, was killed in an Israeli strike in Iran's capital, Tehran. The Israeli government has not commented on the attack, which came a few hours after Israel's Tuesday night strike on Fawud Shukr, a senior Hezbollah commander. It was the first time during the war with Hamas that Israel has targeted a senior Hezbollah leader in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. How will Haniyeh's death affect ongoing talks aimed at reaching a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel? Will the two attacks lead to a wider conflict in the Middle East? VOA's Carol Van Dam put those questions to Nola Haines, political scientist at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service here in Washington.
It is a complicated situation, you know, starting with the assassination or the targeted strike against Ismail Haniyeh while he was in Tehran for the inauguration of the new Iranian president. And then also to rewind just a little bit, there was also the strike that Israel did claim against Fawad Zakour, which is Hezbollah's number two. So these things happen back to back. So we have one situation where there is still the ongoing negotiation for the ceasefire, the permanent ceasefire. Israel definitely wants to get its hostages back, but it also feels that as long as Hamas has any legs left, any sort of leadership left in Gaza, it will not enter into a permanent ceasefire. They want to completely dismantle all of Hamas's leadership. And also Hamas at this point doesn't have much incentive to also agree to the ceasefire. And right now they are limping. You know, they are quite decimated. And the only leverage they have right now are the hostages. So right now the ceasefire deal is in a precarious state, but I know negotiations are still ongoing. I know first and foremost, that is something that the U.S. wants. They want the war to end. But another part to this saga is the simmering situation between Israel and Hezbollah.
Do you see that these two attacks taken together could very well lead to a wider conflict in the Middle East?
There's definitely a lot of escalation fearing that's going on. I want to be a little bit more cautious. We definitely want to hear from Israel. They have not claimed this strike. First of all, there has to be really good intelligence for what seems to be some sort of drone to be able to kill Haniyeh in a bedroom. So just kind of imagine this, the level of intel, the type of targeted strike that it took to kill him in such an intimate setting. So there is an intelligence failure somewhere along the line. So we have to wait and see. We have to wait and see what Israel is going to say. We're going to have to wait and see to see how Hamas will respond to this. I am cautious. I am hopeful. But the reality of the situation, it's not going in a positive direction right now. That's all that I'm willing to say. And then for folks that are, you know, piling on, since Brett McGurk is also in the region, who's the White House's coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa, you know, all of these different conspiracies are building. But we definitely need to be cautious and wait until we have more information.
That was Nola Haines, political scientist at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. Palestinians in Gaza are closely following the U.S. presidential election campaign as Vice President Kamala Harris has become the presumptive Democratic nominee following President Joe Biden's withdrawal from the race. Khalil Jahassan, president of the Arab Center in Washington, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi that Harris may face skepticism among U.S. voters who support Palestinians in the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza.
Undoubtedly, Palestinian citizens in general, particularly in Gaza, are quite attentive these days to the presidential campaign, particularly since the withdrawal of President Biden from the Democratic ticket. So the campaign that's underway here in the United States is getting kind of undue attention in Palestine in general for the average Gazan today. The U.S. is not a bystander in this conflict, hasn't been for the past 10 months almost. So people in Gaza are fully aware of the role that's being played by Washington, and they understand that elections, should they bring about any change, will impact that role and will impact their daily lives in Gaza. Particularly, I think what they are worried about is that we've had an administration that shifted its position over the past, let's say, few months by engaging in diplomatic efforts that the Biden administration pursued, seeking what is perceived as long-lasting ceasefire, which wasn't the case before, where the administration kind of stood in the way. And its policy for the first few months of the war was to give Israel plenty of time to so-called to finish the job. Now it's pressuring Israel to basically, as we've seen during the visit of the Prime Minister of Israel to Washington, Biden, actually both left and right, people whom he met with, advised him to finish the job quickly, or the impression he was left with that the U.S. is not interested in a continuing long-term war in Gaza.
Arab Americans have led the movement towards a call for a ceasefire in Gaza, and in February, the Uncommitted Movement launched a campaign in Michigan, which is a swinging state, to mark uncommitted on Democratic primary ballots as means to voice their message to President Biden for an immediate ceasefire and an end to military aid to Israel. Would this movement back Kamala Harris now, following her latest statements on the Gaza war?
I don't think it will be automatic. Definitely, as we know, there are many attempts, or have been, before even Biden withdrew from the ticket, he sent some people from the campaign to meet with Arab American representatives, particularly from that movement, Uncommitted Vote, within the community. It did not work. People look at Harris in the community slightly different from Biden, but they haven't forgotten the policies that Biden presided over with the help of the vice president. So that's why I say that the shift is not going to be automatic. I think the administration has a lot more to prove and to offer to Arab Americans and Muslim Americans before they can convince them to change their intention of being uncommitted to being enthusiastically involved in the elections.
That was Khalil Jashan, president of the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The Washington Mandela Summit for Young African Leaders is concluding at the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C., as the 2024 cohort of over 700 participants head back to the continent this week. What have been their biggest takeaways? VOA's Anthony Labruto was at the summit and spoke with few of the participants. Yaya Dama is from Burkina Faso.
In the summit, we had the opportunity to meet with all the different leaders who were selected from Africa. So it's a very interesting networking platform where we can meet to our partners to discuss with leaders more deeply, and also the conferences we are still learning from all the different speakers who come and go. So it's really fantastic to be at the summit. And one special thing also is this summit is special as the 10th anniversary of the Yali Mandela Washington Fellowship, which is really special and nice because we have the opportunity to talk to alumni of the program.
Satnag Dumbaya is from Gambia.
I am taken by bravery, I'm taken by commitment, I'm taken by respect for Africa, and this has been instilled in me from the institute that I was at in Great Forest State University. And my interaction with other Africans and Americans have told me that we are powerful, and young people, we do not have to underestimate ourselves. So I'm going back with a lot of courage, with a lot of confidence in me.
The Young African Leaders Initiative is a U.S. State Department program that brings hundreds of young community and business leaders from all over Africa. They take part in a six-week fellowship program at U.S. universities and connect with business and nonprofit leaders. For more on YALI, please check out voaafrica.com. You also can find information on the fellowship and the Mandela Summit at yali.state.gov. Some security experts say militants belonging to Islamic extremist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Islamic State may have undergone military instruction in South Africa under the guise of being trained as security guards. This is the loophole used by 95 alleged members of a Libyan militia arrested last Friday at a training camp run by a security company near a remote town. Darren Taylor reports.
The Libyans entered South Africa on visas entitling them to training as security guards. Instead, say police, they received military instruction involving high-powered weapons and tactics at a camp near the town of White River in South Africa's rural north. On Monday in court, a lawyer for the 95 Libyans insisted they were in South Africa legally to be trained as security guards. Private security consultant and former military officer Neil De Beer has viewed police footage of the training camp where they were arrested last Friday.
And you can see there is what we call a live scenario setup. It is a S-shaped trench covered with sandbags leading up to an underground bunker. Now, I don't know what kind of training a security guard needs to defend a line of trench warfare and underground bunkers.
De Beer has also obtained covert footage of the training that the Libyans received at the camp.
I saw them practicing house clearing. I saw them practicing shoot and move. This is not a normal security guard training, unless this security is being done in the middle of Iraq, Iran, or Afghanistan. This was a camp to train people for war.
Independent security risk analyst Andy Grudko agrees.
Military and paramilitary training camps are nothing new in South Africa. We've had them for literally decades, even in the apartheid era. The political implications of this one are quite interesting because of the political dynamics that are going on up in Libya, which, of course, is a very oil-rich African country and has been in turmoil with various people trying to seize power.
That was Darren Taylor reporting on the Libyan arrested militias. And in our Olympic roundup segment, and Mokbili Abaro, our VOA sports analyst and host of our Olympic podcast, Chasing Gold, is in studio to brief us on the matter. Mokbil, welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you for having me on the show, Yehes.
The U.S. women's gymnastics team won gold yesterday. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is coming off of a Tokyo Olympics, the last Olympics where Simone Biles, the arguably one of the greatest gymnasts, U.S. gymnasts of all time, came back, and she had what they call in the gymnastics world a bad case of the twisties, where your mind and your body are not working together. So she had to take some time, a mental health break away from the competitions. She came back. There was a lot of naysayers on whether or not she could perform, whether this team could perform. They asked them what the nickname of this new team was. And they call themselves now the Golden Girls, right? Because they ended up winning gold with one of the biggest margins. I believe it's the second biggest margin in a team victory. So they won gold in the team artistic gymnastics. The team is Simone Biles, of course, Jordan Childs, Sunny Lee, and Jade Carey. What a phenomenal bunch of young women that have really showcased the gold for the U.S. team.
Jordan Childs, named after Michael Jordan. That was
right. There we go.
So both Egypt and Morocco now qualify for the men's Olympic soccer knockout phase. What are their chances for gold?
Yeah, Morocco looks really good at the moment. This is one of the few teams that have their key players from the Qatar World Cup still in there. Ashraf Hakimi is basically leading his team. He will be going up against the United States on Friday in the quarterfinals, and Egypt will be playing Paraguay on Friday as well. If they're both able to win, they will go to the semifinals. It is exciting. Two teams, two African teams leading the way. We believe that they have a high probability of coming out of their games as well.
And the Australian swimming team has performed exceptional in this year's Olympics. Just give me one number. How many medals have they won so far?
If I'm looking at the Australian swim team, I believe they have 8 medals. They have 4 golds, 3 silvers, and 1 bronze.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.